Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Meghna Chakrabarty, and this is On Point. 150 years ago this week, two steam locomotives face-to-face at Promontory, Utah. The weathered faces of railroad workers gathered around the Golden Spike. That famous photograph captured the culmination of the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad, a monumental infrastructure project that transformed the nation and the American West specifically. But what you don't see in that picture are the tens of thousands of Chinese workers who built the western portion of the railroad. They laid track, dynamited tunnels in the Sierra Nevada mountains, did the work that others would not do. While the railroad may have been a triumph of American ability, what followed was a tragedy of American xenophobia. The story of the Chinese workers was deliberately lost to history. They were excluded from the very American dream they made manifest in the Transcontinental Railroad. Well, my guest today is telling those workers' stories from their point of view for the first time in his new book, This Hour on Point, The Ghosts of Gold Mountain. And you can join us. What do you know of the history of the Chinese laborers who helped create the Transcontinental Railroad? Is your family related? Are you descended from one of those laborers? Or is this history new to you? And what does it tell you about American xenophobia that followed the construction of the Transcontinental Railroad and the racism that befell those very people who helped build it? What does that tell you about where we are today? Does this story sound familiar? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Well, joining us today from Stanford, California, is Gordon H. Chang. He's a professor of American history at Stanford University, co-director of the Chinese Railroad Workers of North America Project. His new book is titled Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. Professor Chang, welcome to On Point.
Thank you. Nice to meet you.
It's terrific to have you. I was wondering, might we just start with an explanation, sort of a deeper exploration of how important and how transformative the Transcontinental Railroad itself was in 1869? Why was this such an important project?
The vision of a transcontinental railroad captivated many Americans actually quite early on in the 19th century, as early as the 1840s, when boosters began to think of a ribbon of iron that would connect the two coasts. But the vision wasn't realized until Abraham Lincoln signed into law a bill that supported the building of the transcontinental. And when it was completed in 1869, it linked the entire country with rail and ushered in the modern age of America. A rail line was the first true infrastructure of the United States, much like the Internet is today, and it facilitated the passage of passengers and freight, raw materials all around the country. And this enabled the boom of the Industrial Revolution following the Civil War, and then the circulation of people all around the country.
Well, when we think about how revolutionary it was, before the Transcontinental Railroad was completed, it might have taken months to get goods across the country from east to west coast. But following the completion of this railroad, that number went down to what, days, a week?
Yeah, it's astounding to think that it would take perhaps 6 weeks to 2 months to get from San Francisco to New York or New York to San Francisco. There were three routes across the continent, which was arduous and time-consuming and dangerous. You could go down to Panama and trek your way across the isthmus and find another ship to come up on the other coast, or go away all the way down the tip of South America and come up again. So it took a long time, and it was dangerous. There was a disease in Panama, and interestingly and tragically, one of the first leaders of the building of the Transcontinental Railroad, Theodore Judah, an engineer who was in San Francisco, was going to New York to raise funds for the project, went across the Panama Isthmus and contracted disease and died. So he was an example of the perilous journey that one would take. But after the building of the Transcontinental, it would take 6-7 days.
Yeah. It's a stunning transformation. So why is it then that for the western portion of the Transcontinental Railroad, the portion that was constructed by the Central Pacific Railroad, how is it that they began to look to Chinese laborers to help help build this monumental national project?
The California in the 18 California became a state of the Union in 1850. And began to develop steadily, but it was still a long way to go because of the remoteness of the state. Even with all its natural resources and attractions in the port of San Francisco, the Sierra Nevada mountain range, which separated the state from the rest of the country and even Nevada, was a big barrier. And the railroad leaders of the Central Pacific, the president being Leland Stanford, the namesake, the benefactor of my own university, thought that and his collaborators wanted to hire only white labor. They were prejudiced. They were very racist. Stanford, who was as governor of the state, had made openly racist comments and statements in trying to exclude Chinese from the state altogether. But
if I may, Professor Chang, just because it is so ironic that Leland Stanford, where you are now at Stanford University. I mean, he was extremely racist, right? You quote, there's a letter from him in 1862. No, his inaugural address, right?
His inaugural address
as governor of California, right? In where he said the settlement, quote, the settlement among us of an inferior race, a degraded and distinct people exercising a deleterious effect on the superior race. I mean,
You got it right there. I mean, that he couldn't be more explicit that he wanted to attract a white population to the state and have a white state. But Chinese did come slowly in the 1850s and in some number, and were in the state already. But by 1863, when the Central Pacific began construction, the leaders couldn't hire on the number of white workers that they wanted. And they came on by a few hundred or so. They needed thousands. And so one day, Charles Crocker, one of the so-called Big Four, said, why don't we try Chinese workers? And they were quite reluctant and divided about this. But really, out of desperation, they turned to Chinese. The interesting story, if you don't mind sharing this with you, The question often arises, where did the idea of using Chinese come from?
I was just wondering that, yes.
if the railroad leaders were so prejudiced. Well, it's said that Charles Crocker, manservant, a Chinese, a man with whom he had confidence, and it was apparently this fellow was quite capable and more than just a servant, but it was inside the house and heard all the troubles of the Transcontinental Railroad hiring laborers. And he said to Charles Crocker one day, why don't you hire Chinese? So the idea of hiring Chinese onto the line may have come from a Chinese person himself.
Huh. Well, but when we say Chinese, did they begin by looking at those Chinese or Chinese Americans, as we would say now, who were already in California? Because soon thereafter, we're talking about ultimately some 20,000 workers, and they weren't all already in California.
That's right. Chinese came to California following the California Gold Rush. It began in 1849. And so through the 1850s and early 1860s, Chinese began to arrive in the developing state. And they engaged in all sorts of occupations. They were prospectors, miners in some number, but also as workers. They were hired on as laborers and construction workers in California mines and the developing fields and the building infrastructure for the state. And so they were here in some numbers. Observers at the time who traveled in the state wondered at all so many things out here in California were very proud of, the trees and the mountains and stuff. And they say they saw Chinese everywhere because they had settled throughout the mining region and the farming region of Northern California. So the southern part of the state was quite underdeveloped at the time. And so they were available and had engaged in infrastructure work before, and the railroad turned to Chinese labor contractors, sort of middlemen who could recruit these workers and then hire them on to the Central Pacific.
So recruiting them from China?
No, well, at first, they would hire them from around the state.
Yes.
And they came on quite steadily. If they, Crocker and the others used some Chinese workers to try to do the light work. The railroad barons were skeptical that the Chinese could. First, they didn't know if they really wanted them or they could be managed or whether they were temperamentally or physically suitable for construction, railroad construction work. But they hired on 50 at first, and another 50 came on. And very soon, by the end of 1864, there were thousands working for the railroad company and insufficient in the state in number to fulfill the labor needs of the railroad company. So the company sent out messengers handbills to China to recruit workers all the way from there to come to California and work directly for the railroad.
Right. Well, we'll talk more about that when we come back from a break. But your book sheds light on so many little details about this massive story that just really, that some of them are hard to hear in through 2019 ears, right? Because, for example, you tell the story of James Strobridge, one of the superintendents on this project, who said, quote, "I will not boss Chinese." But it was Crocker who responded by saying, "Well, didn't they build the Chinese Wall?" The biggest piece of masonry in the world. So just pushing back against these assumptions that these workers wouldn't have the constitution or the willingness to do this job. It's incredible. But Gordon Chang, stand by for just a second, because we have a lot more that we have to dig into after a quick break. We are talking with Professor Gordon Chang. His new book is Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. And we want to hear from you. Do you have family members or ancestors who helped build this massive infrastructure project in the middle of the 19th century? And what does the story of how America treated these workers, after they help fulfill an aspect of the American dream, what does it tell you about what we're doing today? We'll be right back. This is On Point.
Support for the On Point podcast comes from Indeed. If you need to hire, you need Indeed. Indeed is your matching and hiring platform that lets you find candidates fast. Ditch the busy work and use Indeed for scheduling, screening, and messaging so you can connect with candidates faster. And listeners get a $75 sponsored job credit to get your jobs more visibility at Indeed.com/on point. That's Indeed.com/on point. Terms and conditions apply. Need to hire? You need Indeed.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're speaking today with Gordon H. Chang. He is author of Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. He's also co-director of the Chinese Railroad Workers in North America Project and a professor of American history at Stanford University. And he joins us today from Stanford, California. Professor Chang, I'd love for you to share much more of the detail that you write about in the book about the particular work that these Chinese laborers were doing on the western portion of the Transcontinental Railway, because they were what, some 90% of the laborers that were working for Central Pacific at the time?
Yes. At the high point of their work on the line, they numbered perhaps up to 15,000. And with turnover, that's how we get to the number of 20,000. Yeah. But the railroad company didn't keep really close personnel records, is what we would call them today. So we don't know a lot of things with much precision. The railroad company, it might be too callous to say they were callous towards the Chinese, but they were really much more concerned about just getting the work done, and the workers would just want to get the work done for them. But there was this astounding amount of work that was required to build this rail line through up through the Central Valley into the Sierra foothills, and then up into the summit area, the Sierra Nevada summit, which the Sierra Nevada mountain range is the toughest mountain range in the continental United States. And it is characterized by dramatic shifts in weather and climatic conditions snow falls that will create drifts up to 40 feet during the wintertime, and be so dense that people couldn't travel through the passes. The most well-known tragic example of illustrating this is the Donner Party that tried to get into California in the late 1840s, got trapped by early summer winter snow, and got trapped there for a long period of time and ran out of food and resorted to cannibalism. But that where they got stuck, it was now called Donner Pass, and that's exactly where the railroad line had to get through. And the railroad company, in competition with the Union Pacific, which was coming westward from Omaha, wanted to lay as much track as possible. And many people at this time thought the Central Pacific leaders were a bit daft for thinking they could get a railroad through the Sierra Nevada. But they did, and with the work of Chinese railroad workers.
Yeah.
The difficult thing was to get through the dense conifer tree forests of the California, and then through the passes of the Sierra, which required the construction, the digging out, blasting of 15 tunnels through granite.
Well, so tell us more about that, because it sounds like, I mean, it's dangerous work today. It sounds like it would be even more dangerous a century and a half ago.
Well, one writer, a friend of mine who heard about this work, called the construction of the railroad an artisanal project. And I thought that was making it quite pleasant sounding. But I think he meant that it was all hand done. It was craft work. And that was absolutely true. There were no power tools as we know them today. There was only chisels, iron chisels and sledgehammers and shovels and carts, horse-drawn carts, and blasting powder, black powder, which they used for gunpowder, which was called gunpowder at the time. And that were the only tools they had to, and of course, saws to cut the trees. But this was all handwork, and that's why they needed such an enormous amount of labor to fell the trees, clear the roadbed, fill in the ravines, build trestles, complete cuts through rises, and then snake all the way up through the Sierra and into the summit area. The most demanding challenge was to construct what became known as Summit Tunnel that ran ultimately more than 1,600 feet in length through a solid granite mountain. And the workers tackled this mountain, this tunnel, and they, from two directions, from the east side of the tunnel and the west side. And it took them more than 2 years to complete this tunnel. Now, one astounding story is that the work was going too slowly for the railroad company leaders, and they got the Chinese to dig a shaft from the top of the mountain down to the center point of where the tunnel was to go. So I always ask my audiences, you know, how does one build a tunnel in four directions at the same time? And you do that by building the shaft down to the middle and then digging out in two directions out toward the portals. So they were able to double the rate of progress with that work. But I can't imagine being stuck in the bowels of a mountain 100 feet down from the surface and working in that dark, dank area, carving out through granite and laying explosives, and then getting carted out through that elevator for safety.
Wow. So given the nature of the work they were doing and the majority of it on the western portion of the Transcontinental Railroad, it doesn't sit well to discover that there was this vast pay differential, right? These laborers were getting paid, what, a third that other non-Chinese or I should say that the white laborers were getting paid? And it was such a problem that the Chinese laborers even went in, all of them went on strike at one point in time?
Yes, the Chinese were paid approximately a third. Some people say, some calculate a half of the pay of white workers on the Central Pacific. And in addition, the Chinese had to pay for their own food, which the company provided or sold to them. And so they made double amount of money from the Chinese workers in some sense. And they were paid even less, you can calculate even less than the workers paid on the Union Pacific side that was in competition with the Central Pacific. So the pay differential was enormous.
Well, listen, we have lots of callers who want to join us, and there's so much more detail to dig in through. But let's go to Eric, who's calling from San Francisco, California. Eric, you're on the air.
Hi. I just wanted to say that in my family history, I may have had some I'm Chinese American, may have had some ancestors that came over here to work on the railroad. For sure, on my maternal grandmother's side, I think in the 1870s, had a great-grandfather who came over here to, you know, to look for his fortune, and I think he may have been a prospector. And, you know, to see that the railroad workers, the Chinese railroad workers at the time, did not get any credit in that photo at Promontory, Utah, is pretty bad. And, you know, it's just kind of reflective of what's going on now in society with immigrants from other places, you know, especially from south of the border, where there's a total love-hate relationship. Love the work that they provide and add to the economy, but you don't really like them because of the race.
Yeah. Well, Eric, thank you so much for your call. And actually, on that point, I want to bring into the conversation now Lisa C. She joins us from Los Angeles. Her great-grandfather worked on the Transcontinental Railroad, and Lisa is also author of On Gold Mountain, The 100-Year Odyssey of My Chinese-American Family. Lisa C., welcome to On Point.
Thank you for having me.
So, reflect on what you just heard our caller Eric say, that his family, like yours, has been in the United States for more than a century and a half, and still feels to this day some sense of people not recognizing that legacy or that history.
Right, because I think one of the things that's really interesting about the building of the Transcontinental Railroad and the use of Chinese labor, including my actually great-great-grandfather who came to work as an herbalist on the railroad, is that once the railroad was completed, all of a sudden you had all of these laborers who'd had a lot of experience in building something like the railroad, and they dispersed in every direction from Promontory, Utah, and helped to build the entire infrastructure of the West, you know, roads and bridges and levees and other railroad spurs. And this, to this day, I think, is really invisible work that hasn't been acknowledged and helped to build the West.
And we should note that these Chinese workers who came to the United States to build this project and stayed, they were officially denied the opportunity to become naturalized U.S. citizens, right?
Yes, until 1943.
Until 1943. So
right.
80, almost 90 years.
Right.
I
think that this goes back to what your caller said and what Gordon was talking about earlier is, you know, this sense of racism, I mean, not a sense, actual racism that was going on. And you know, once the railroad was completed and now this journey that had been so arduous was reduced down to 1 week, you had a huge influx of white labor into California. And, you know, this becomes this big rallying point of we want, you know, white labor wants those jobs, wants all of the jobs, and push to get rid of Chinese entirely. And this leads to a period called the Driving Out, which eventually results in the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882. Mm. And then that stays in effect until 1943.
So, Lisa, tell us, I'm going to get back to the Chinese Exclusion Act in just a moment here, but tell us more about your, I'm sorry, I might have said it, I didn't have enough greats in there earlier, but
I know it's hard.
Your great-great-grandfather. I mean, what more do you know about him and the work he did as an herbalist?
Well, first, that he, like many laborers in China, I mean, was very poor. You know, times were very difficult there. They had had the Taiping Rebellion. There were 30 million people died. They had had serious drought followed by famine. And so life was difficult, you know, for everyone. And And so when people came to say, look, there's some jobs over there in California, people would go, like my great-great-grandfather, coming as what they called sojourners, people who didn't expect to stay forever, but just to come and work and send money home, and then to also take money home and help to transform their lives. So it's the same kind of push and pull that we have with immigration all the way to today. So he came here to, you know, not intending to stay, but just to send money home back to his family. And he was an herbalist. I would not say he was like a real doctor. He's what you would call a barefoot doctor in China that I could maybe say more like a quack. But, you know, somebody who would travel village to village with his sons, and they would put on an acrobatic show and then sell the different kinds of maybe more like home remedies. And the railroad administration knew that the workers, the Chinese workers, didn't trust Western doctors or Western medicine, and in fact wanted people that understood their way of looking at medicine. And so that's why my great-great-grandfather came.
Right. Gordon Chang, let me turn back to you here. What happened, after the completion of the Transcontinental Railroad, were those Chinese workers, were they actively encouraged to return to China? I mean, how many of them did and how many of them stayed?
Well, by the time the line got to Promontory Summit in 1869, there were thousands of Chinese still employed by the Central Pacific. The numbers have fluctuated depending upon the terrain and the season. But after the events on May 10th, many were sent back to rebuild portions of the line that needed some work, or some started to go work for the Union Pacific. Lisa mentioned the dispersal of Chinese around the West, where they went beyond the West. They went to the Midwest. They went to the far east coast of the United States, and also to the South. And there were Chinese railroad workers throughout the entire country, from Long Island to Tennessee to Alabama to Southern California. The Scientific American, in, I think, 1870, declared that the Chinese were born railroad workers. They had established themselves as such experienced and capable railroad workers that people all around the country locally and regionally wanted to hire Chinese. So many did go out to other parts of the country and began to establish Chinese communities throughout the West, in Boise or in the Midwest, in Chicago and in New York. It's at the same time that white immigrants and others were coming out to California, Chinese were going the other direction and going throughout the entire country.
Right.
But the anti-Chinese movement drove many of them out of these areas, and they disappeared from scores of communities where they had settled.
So this brings us back to what Lisa was saying about the Chinese Exclusion Act, because I feel like there's a repetitive refrain in American history here that, in a sense, gets its first start with the Chinese Exclusion Act of 1882, right? It was the first significant law passed by Congress that it provided first significant law exclusively restricting labor coming from another country, right?
Targeting Chinese specifically, of Chinese laborers were prohibited from entry into the country.
For a 10-year moratorium, the first time the United States had felt strongly enough to specifically target labor from another country. I mean, was it because these Chinese laborers were so instrumental and so good at the work they were doing on the Transcontinental Railroad?
That's a good way to put it. They were two good workers. They attracted the kind of envy, and they were felt they were workers, native or other workers, couldn't compete with the Chinese because they were so capable or had lived more frugally than the others did, and so therefore became targets of hostility rather than being attracted. But so the Chinese Exclusion Act was a combination of a politics and xenophobia. The anti-Chinese sentiment was a popular political rallying cry for different politicians of all different parties. But also, at the same time, there was a counter trend, and that's important to also recognize, is that many did want to have the Chinese Day, and in fact, even bring more here. And the Chinese Exclusion Act was passed in 1882, but there were previous attempts to pass the bill, which were vetoed by the presidents of the United States because they said the Chinese were needed here for their labor and to help build railroads.
Well, none other than Frederick Douglass once gave a speech decrying rules or laws being passed against Chinese immigrants. He said that, "I submit that this question of Chinese immigration should be settled upon higher principles than those of a cold and selfish expediency. There are such things in this world as human rights." That was from Frederick Douglass in 1869. So we have to take a quick break. Gordon Chang and Lisa C., stand by for just a second. We're talking about Gordon Chang's new book, Ghosts of Gold Mountain. We'll be right back. This is On Point.
A gruesome scandal at the nation's most prestigious university shines a light on a macabre and lucrative world of buying and selling human remains.
Human body parts taken by a manager at the Harvard Medical School morgue and then sold to customers online.
So my first skull is right there on the top shelf. That's my first and my favorite.
I'm reporter Allie Jarmani, and this story raises some tough questions. How should we treat the dead? And who gets to decide?
There should be some middle ground where we treat deceased tissues differently than we treat old refrigerators.
This is Postmortem, The Stolen Bodies of Harvard, a new season of WBUR's Last Scene. Listen and follow Last Scene wherever you get your podcasts.
This is On Point. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're talking this hour with Professor Gordon H. Chang. He's author of the new book, Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. We're also joined by Lisa C. Her great-great-grandfather worked on the Transcontinental Railroad, and she's author of On Gold Mountain, the 100-year odyssey of my Chinese-American family. Lisa, I have just one more question before we have to let you go. We can't escape these, you know, historical echoes here. So I'm just wondering what lessons you feel we should be drawing from the story of the Chinese laborers 150 years ago versus, you know, the nation's struggle, not versus, in light of the nation's struggles with immigration now.
Well, we are doomed, it seems, to repeat the mistakes of the past, but I wonder sometimes if we can sort of shift our thinking and look back and see mistakes that we did make and try to correct them, in the sense that so much of the language that's used to talk about immigrants today is the exact same language that was used in the build-up to the Chinese Exclusion Act. And even in the days before the railroad company hired Chinese. So these are things like, you know, they're dirty, they will bring crime, they will pollute our race, they're going to rape our women, they eat weird food, they don't speak our language, they can never become Americans. And that, you know, those things that were said about the Chinese are said about so many different immigrant groups today. And yet we know from where we are in American society today that Chinese were able not only to help build this country, but also and become part of the fabric of the country, but have been incredible contributors, not just in the days of the railroad, but all the way to today. And so we could think about immigrants who are coming in today and in a different light and where they could be in 25 years, 50 years, or in this case, you know, 150 years later.
Yeah. Well, Lisa C., author of On Gold Mountain, the 100-year odyssey of my Chinese-American family, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me.
Professor Chang, I will come back to you here in just a second, but we have callers who want to share their stories, too. So let's go to Dan, who's calling from Lexington, Kentucky. Dan, you're on the air.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. As an Asian American man, it's heartbreaking and mind-boggling to think that the history of Chinese Americans, starting from the gold rush, has affected people even now, people like myself, particularly in the perceptions of Asian American males and females, but males in particular, of this emasculated perception of Asian men at large, but Chinese men. You know, when we first came to this country, we wore these long robes and we had these long, like, queues of ponytails, and we were slighter in stature than white Americans, and all that kind of fed into it. But only recently did I read more about how much legislation there was that basically kind of systematically emasculated Chinese men in terms of who could come into the country and whether they were single, whether they could bring families, and all these sort of effects. And I would love to hear from Professor Chan if he could speak more about sort of the systemic emasculation of Chinese American men.
All right. Well, Dan, thank you for your call. Professor Chang, would you like to respond?
Well, that's a good point. It's a horrible thing to think about. But your caller is on the point with historical stereotyping of Chinese and Chinese men in particular, and both the literal and figurative emasculation of Chinese males. After the building of the Transcontinental, as was mentioned before, there was a virulent anti-Chinese movement arose that forced Chinese out of many different communities, including at times with tremendous violence. Chinese were massacred around the country, killed in scores of incidents around the Pacific Northwest and the Rocky Mountain regions, Rock Springs, Wyoming. Miners killed almost 30 Chinese miners in Los Angeles in 1871. Some 20 Chinese were lynched, including some who were physically emasculated, and then they were mutilated. So this was the reality of Chinese around the country, terribly and ironically, in some sense, as a result of their work on the Transcontinental itself. And the response to my work and to the story of the Chinese railroad workers is interesting among many Chinese Americans and others today. In out of this feeling of passion of wanting to reclaim this history, of being embedded in the telling of American history. And there's also a dimension which is, I think, notable, which is it's the sense of, you know, what can be more American than building a railroad?
Right.
And what can be more masculine in sense of being a railroad worker? We have so many stories and other aspects of American history that emphasize that. And so I think this response of to my work and to other work of other people who've been trying to reclaim Chinese railroad history is indicative of the sense of longing, of wanting to recover the past, but also seeing this as a really deep contemporary emotional issue.
I mean, doesn't it just shine a light on an unsavory American truth? And that is, since the founding of this nation, we have looked upon certain groups of people, whether they were enslaved or brought over specifically for labor, as labor, not as immigrants, but as workers. And then once those groups of people, to put it bluntly, exhaust their usefulness to the nation, we don't want them anymore.
Yeah, well, we sort of exhaust, we squeeze the lemon.
Yeah.
let's toss them out, and then that's tragically the case. But there's also the point that might be made is that the labor market is not as set, if you will, a pie, which is only a certain number of slices can be had by people. When you have available labor, the economists and actually the railroad leaders at the time made the same argument that when Chinese workers were able to come onto the line, it allowed the company to hire many more white workers onto the line, because the company was criticized for it. Said, why do you hire so many Chinese? Why don't you hire whites? They said, well, we tried to, but we couldn't. And they said, aren't the Chinese taking jobs away from whites? I said, no, not really. In fact, with their labor and building the infrastructure and coming on to the line in such numbers, it actually expanded the economy and the business operation. And we could therefore hire not just a few hundred, but many hundreds of white workers. So white workers actually benefited also from the employment of masses of Chinese workers.
Mm. Well, Professor Chang, I imagine that some people listening to this might say, I knew the story of the massive contribution of Chinese workers to the Transcontinental Railroad, especially folks on the West Coast in California. It may not be an unfamiliar story to them, but you've done something very different here in your book. You've tried to tell this story through the voices and the stories of the workers themselves. Now, this proved to be quite a challenge, because I was surprised to learn that even though many, many, many of these workers were literate, they were possibly sending letters home, that there's next to no none of those original letters or their written record of their experiences building the Transcontinental Railroad.
Yes, this is the big intellectual challenge that has stymied historians, Chinese-American community historians over decades. We've been looking for material. I've been looking for material for decades of my life, but there's not a single document we've located from the hand of a Chinese railroad worker.
How is that possible?
Nothing here in the United States, in China, Canada. We've looked all around the world. And at the same time, roughly, the Civil War, we have hundreds, if not thousands, of Civil War diaries, soldiers writing home and so forth, but not a single document from the Chinese themselves. And so we don't have their words to tell us what their lived experience was like. You know, why don't we have that material? Well, the area from which they came in China, as Lisa mentioned, was a poor area. It was also overrun with civil unrest and wars and revolution through the 19th and 20th century. So lots of stuff was destroyed in China. And in the United States, we also mentioned the anti-Chinese movement of the 1870s and 1880s, where Chinese communities were decimated, their materials burned. So we think a lot of stuff was lost. We know many of the Chinese were literate. We know they wrote letters home. We think there were probably artists, there were cooks. There were all a variety of different people, and they kept material. And there's an interesting little story about the conclusion of the events at Promontory Summit. When after the dignitaries left, the Chinese who had literally laid the last rail, the ceremonial rails and track and all this, the ties, and then replaced them with the real stuff. But they all the different sort of stuff around the area, they descended upon and kept all sorts of memorabilia. The newspaper reporters talked about the Chinese keeping all sorts of stuff that they wanted to as a keepsake. But none of that has survived. And so it's the textual material as well as even the physical objects that they collected have disappeared.
So what sources then did you go to craft this book from the point of view of these very workers?
Well, one important decision I had to make is from what position would I write this story? And I decided that I had to write this from the position of a Chinese railroad worker as much as I could, to take their position. And that meant to look out at the world from their vantage point and not look at them from an external standpoint. So I tried to understand the rhythm of their lives, the culture that they brought with them, their customs, their belief, their attitude towards nature and the sky and the rhythms of the weather, and then to read the material that we did have, including journalism articles. There are hundreds of articles that talk about Chinese railroad workers that we've located. Mm. And then we also used new creative methodologies, and I collaborated with a wonderful archaeologist who have worked along the rail lines in the West and found tens of thousands of pieces of artifacts left behind by Chinese railroad workers.
Fascinating.
Intact rice wine jugs and soy sauce jugs, and as well as little shards of rice bowls and gaming pieces. And they studied the labor camps from where they lived, and they get some sense of the organization of these camps, their longevity, and what happened in those camps, that the material culture can tell us something about their day-to-day lives. So This is a different kind of a historical approach than just relying on written documents.
Let's go to Dave, who's calling from Wisconsin Rapids, Wisconsin. Dave, you're on the air.
Hi, this is a timely topic in this particular climate. We're in political climate. I'm an 83-year-old man who remembers the story of the golden spike from grade school. Didn't see anything about any Chinese workers. But my wife and I just recently drove to California, and we drove on Interstate 80, which kind of parallels a lot of the railroad that you're talking about. We stopped for gas in a little town in Wyoming called Rock Springs. And as I was filling up my tank, I remembered reading about this place, and it occurred to me what it was about. And it's a kind of a dusty little Wyoming town, but I remembered reading about a massacre there of Chinese workers who I presume might have been descendants of some of the railroad workers, or perhaps some of the elderly railroad workers. And I wonder if your guest could talk about that particular incident.
Well, Dave, thank you for your call. Professor Chang, do you know what Dave's referring to?
Rock Springs, Wyoming was the location of a mining operation. And hundreds of workers of all descents were employed there, including many Chinese, many of whom had come right from the railroad. And the massacre that the fellow mentioned here, your caller, happened, I believe, in early 1880s. So it was not long after the promontory events. Yeah. And there was a scandal, international scandal, because I think 28 were killed quite brutally. And there was an international commission to investigate, and they discovered the identities of those who were killed, and several of them were identified as having worked on the railroad itself. Mm. So the railroad story doesn't stop at Promontory Summit, but continues on. And it's interesting that some of your callers reference that they are descendants of railroad workers, and many Chinese Americans are very proud of this history and want it to be known for themselves personally, but for the community and for the good of the country, to know that our history is very diverse. America has been created by the labor of many different types of people.
Well, Professor Chang, we have a minute and a half left to go. It's not enough time. But I was wondering if you could give us a tiny little taste of the story of a key person in your book, Hung Hwa, because you say his life experiences are emblematic of the void of the history of the Chinese impact on the Transcontinental Railroad. Can you tell us a little bit about Hung Hwa?
When my research started, I was really looking for a character or some people, individuals, to know a specific part of the story. And I stumbled across this fellow named Hung Hwa, who lived in Auburn, California, north of Sacramento. And he turns out to have been a very entrepreneurial guy, a young man who came to the United States in the 1850s and established himself as a businessman, a labor contractor in the area. So he had good skills. He had language skills. He could recruit workers, Chinese workers, to work for white employers, and he did so. And he even advertised in the local newspaper saying, I can provide any number of Chinese workers to work on roads and mining and railroad operations. And I think that he was the first to bring on Chinese railroad workers to the Central Pacific.
Right.
And he worked all the way through from 1864 all the way to 1869, I think. And so we do now have real identities, personalities, not just nameless figures, not just strong backs and arms of these railroad workers, but actual individuals that we can identify with.
Well, Gordon H. Chang, the new book is Ghosts of Gold Mountain, the epic story of the Chinese who built the Transcontinental Railroad. It's been a great pleasure to speak with you, Professor Chang. Thank you so much.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, Mengning.
And by the way, at our website, we have some photographs from Professor Chang's book of workers on the Transcontinental Railroad. It's fantastic. Check it out, onpointradio.org. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. This is On Point.